Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The lights are out in New York tonight and into the Northeast, the Midwest, and parts of Canada. Air conditioning off, cell phones out of service, no subways or traffic lights in New York, Detroit, Toronto, and beyond. Hospitals running on emergency generators, millions on hold in the summer heat. Tonight On Point, blackout. Joining me from New York right now, Ellis Hennekin, columnist for Newsday newspaper. Hello, Ellis Hennekin.
Hi, Tom. How are you there?
I'm well. Where are you exactly, Ellis?
I've just come back to our newsroom in Manhattan, Park and 33rd, and I've been out on the street for a bit, and I'm just filing my column.
So tell us, Ellis, what have you seen?
Well, so far, you got to say we are hanging amazingly well. There is no great sense of panic on the street. People are getting home as well as they can. You're right, the subways are not running, but you do not have the sense, talking to New Yorkers, at least in the neighborhoods that I've been around to in the past couple of hours, you do not have a sense of disaster, of deep upset, of that this is a city that is in any deep trouble yet.
Ellis, we have the feeling that first tremor of fear passed. It was handled pretty well by public announcements from Mayor Michael Bloomberg and others. I mean, the terror fear certainly was there at the beginning. We had reports of New Yorkers running through the streets in Lower Manhattan kind of instinctively with the memory of 9/11 imprinted. But there's been a lot of public conversation now, people saying this is not terrorism. The power is coming back on, if slowly. Is there any sign of the power coming back yet?
There is not anywhere that I have been. We hear reports in other parts of New York State and elsewhere of things coming back, but the city is still dark. We're all looking, of course, forward to 7:56, which is the official sunset this evening. You know, there is the fear in everybody's mind that what is an inconvenience on a bright summer afternoon becomes something worse and something darker, if you'll excuse the pun, after the sun goes down. And so it sure would be nice if we could get at least some of that power back in the next hour or so.
That with the memories of 1965, when there was blackout and riots,
too, which in some ways was worse. You know, those both happened at nighttime. And, we've got a running start, and I think the signs are, I would say, a little more upbeat at this point.
They sound like it. Ellis, did you see an increased security presence on the streets, more New York Police Department reps out there at this point?
You know, there are cops on the street, but what was more striking to me really was the opposite. Not as many sirens as you would expect, far fewer honking horns. You know, on a normal summer day, I'm now 8 floors up from Park Avenue and 33rd. You know, there's horns blasting. I got to tell you, Bob, if anything, there is less of that than there might be on a normal day.
Now, the physical logistics of this blackout so far, they have been impressive. All three New York airports down, the subways down, elevators in the high-rises out of service. What have you seen? That there must have been thousands of New Yorkers who found themselves suddenly, just after 4 o'clock, in the dark, underground, and had to feel their way along the subway tracks to get out of there.
Well, you're absolutely right to think about the subway. That is the area where the real numbers are. Thankfully, the actual movement of the trains, which happens on the third rail here with direct current, that didn't go out. And so the signal system went out, which made the train slower and caused a lot of problems. But at least in most cases that we've been able to find, people were indeed trapped in those trains for half an hour or an hour and sometimes even longer. But gradually the Transit Authority was able to inch the trains into stations and in the darkness get people out. We do not yet have reports of any kind of massive injuries or anything like that. But you know, hey, it's a very big system, 720 miles of it underground and above ground, and you know, I'm not sure that we've reached every inch yet.
And thousands of those people now on the sidewalks and in the streets, trying to walk home or at least to some place where they can spend the night. Ellis Hennekin, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Karen Pellin. She's a freelance producer for WBUR, also on the line with us tonight from New York. Hi, Karen. Where are you?
Hi. I am in the Village. I'm at the corner of LaGuardia and Bleecker Street.
And what do you see there?
Well, here it's pretty calm. problem. I have walked here from where I was, where I came up to the surface streets outside of the subway system at 34th Street. I walked all the way down 6th Avenue, which was pretty chaotic. It's a major, major thoroughfare. Horns honking, emergency vehicles screaming up and down the street, pedestrians definitely feeling like they have the right of way. I would not want to be in a car. I came down here because this is where I was supposed to be for a concert, which appears to not be happening, but I was in the subway, trapped for about a half hour. Nobody really knew what was happening.
So Karen, just so I understand, when the power went out, you were in a subway somewhere under Manhattan.
I was on the F train. We had just pulled out of Herald Square at 34th Street heading downtown. We were lucky enough, the rear two cars of the train were still in the station. So after about a half hour, they ushered everybody to the rear of the train where we got out, and we're able to find our way through the darkness up to the street, right outside of Penn Station, which was, I might add, an immense crowd situation. It was unbelievable.
But so far, Ellis and Karen, both describing a city that that may have had its chaotic moments, but fairly calm.
Yeah.
So far, Tom. I mean, you know, who knows whether the difference will be between night and day in an hour or two from now. But yeah, I mean, we've been looking very hard for you know, examples of some kind of criminality, examples of serious fires, or some kind of stuff that went beyond jitters and frustration and irritation. We haven't found it yet.
Karen, you were in the subway. You heard people muttering, talking, whatever. Was there fear of terrorism when the lights first went out?
Well, in my mind, there was, because I'm new to the city. I've only been here less than a year. I was with a friend of mine. Nobody said anything for a few minutes. The lights came on immediately, the auxiliary lights.
Right.
And, you know, nobody had any news. So somebody made a comment about, you know, if it's a bomb, we would hear it, or, you know. Nothing really. I mean, we were all in good spirits. When we finally got up on the street, the rumors were flying. I mean, we had people saying that there were bombs. They had heard something about a bomb, and I just didn't want to pay any attention to any of it. But most people in good humor, establishments putting their businesses out on the sidewalk, selling people water, letting people come in to use their bathrooms. I hung out in a bar for a little while. People were giving away drinks, and so really no signs of panic. You know, I mean, there was that initial feeling, but
kind of inevitable. But people got over to it. Ellis, the modern world's jungle drum, the cell phone, famous on 9/11 for all the conversations. Today we read that cell phone service went out, or at least some of it went out. What's
the
story?
I gotta tell you, my cell wasn't working, and I could not reach anybody on a cell. It's surprisingly, a lot of the landlines were. Working, Tom. I'm going to have to run and go get back to my column. Let me give you my lead. Tell me if you think I'm on track.
Okay, let's hear it.
It says, so the power went out yesterday afternoon. What? You thought that was going to bring us to our knees?
So who are you addressing there, Ellis Hennigan? Who are you addressing?
Well, my readers and my fellow New Yorkers, now at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, I may have to revise that when something really bad happens. But for the moment, I think we're all feeling a little cocky about
it. But so far, so good in New York. And Ellis, give us your prognostication for tonight. If the lights don't come back on, what's the mood of New York City? Are we going to hear the sound of breaking glass?
I certainly hope not. I would say that at this point, there is nothing on the sidewalks and street corners that tells me, as a longtime New Yorker, that that's coming. But I got to tell you, I would not want you to make tape of me assuring you that it wasn't, and then you and I have to face each other tomorrow morning.
Yeah, well,
let's see how it goes, all right?
We wish the best to New York City and cities across the country. Ellis Hennigan, columnist for Newsday, thanks for joining us. And Karen Pelland, we're glad you're off that dark subway and up in the light of day. Be safe.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. I am joined now on the telephone by Ernst Moniz. He is professor of physics at MIT. He was undersecretary of energy for the Clinton administration, knows a lot about how power is generated and about how power flows. Good evening and welcome, professor.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Can you please give us a sense? No one knows exactly what happened here, as far as I know. We first had a report that a power plant went down in Manhattan that disrupted the system. Now there's talk of some power transmission breakdown in Canada. But what makes something like this happen? As you look out at the reports that we're all seeing, and maybe you've got more than we do, what is likely to be going on here?
Well, I'm afraid I don't have more than you do about what's happening today, but perhaps it's worth making a few words of kind of perspective, because I think often we don't appreciate what a complex system we have to deliver power to our homes. I've always found it nice to observe that in 2000, the National Academy of Engineering evaluated the most impressive engineering achievements of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the century of lasers and computers and many technologies that we all see every day. And yet, they said the most impressive achievement was electricity grids because of what it does to quality of life.
Well, how does an electricity grid work?
Right. So as I say that, exactly to get across, first of all, the idea that it's a very complex machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you might think of it as a superhighway system in which power plants at different places are shooting electrons around. However, electricity, in contrast to other things, say natural gas, which comes through our homes, essentially cannot be stored. So this machine has to work essentially in perfect balance of supply and demand. All the cycles going together. Very complicated.
That means power plant's pumping out electricity, and it has to flow somewhere and be used as it's generated.
Exactly. So the loads and the transmission and the generation, it all has to be in sync. So consequently, sometimes when those grids or that highway system suddenly gets congested or it breaks in some place, overheating of the line because the loads are too big, it can propagate somewhat along the lines of what we're seeing today, and we've seen in the past, some years ago, of course, where huge areas can suddenly go down.
Now, we're hearing just now that 21 power plants went down within 3 minutes, I guess, near the beginning of this blackout. Can it happen just that fast, a surge or a break somewhere, and down they all go?
Or it could be that load suddenly vanished because the grid went down and these plants then shut off. I think we should not speculate too much
mm-hmm.
on right now cause and effect. We probably don't know quite enough. But in fact, there is it is well known that there is a huge congestion problem, if you like, on this transmission highway between New York and upstate and Canada. I don't know if that's where the cause is, but there are several places in the country, California is a famous one, where there are well-known major congestion problems, and these grid problems nationally just have not been addressed adequately.
And this
frankly, the analog to the highways, it's like we are running our new high-powered cars
mm-hmm.
on old dirt roads.
Meaning, when you say there's congestion, that the physical infrastructure, the wires, the cables, are not sufficient to allow the volume of electricity moving over them to smoothly move.
That's basically right. And you can overheat, and you can bring lines down. We need to have a much more modern grid, and of course that runs into heavy political problems.
Because it's expensive, because it requires putting new lines over people's backyards. Why?
All the above. Certainly, the issues of rights of way is a very critical one. As you know, we all like electricity, but we don't like lines. New lines are coming in, certainly in our neighborhoods. But it also involves, frankly, a confusion in regulation. The California crisis of a few years ago brought this out in great detail. We have a system, electricity, which by its nature flows over very, very large distances to serve customers, and yet we have a patchwork of rules and regulations in many parts of the country where states, for example, set laws which may not be consistent with, if you like, the interstate highway concept.
Now, presumably, Ernest Moniz, what happened today obviously is not supposed to happen. This is highly disruptive, highly expensive, maybe even dangerous to people's lives. We'll find out tonight, I guess. But does it mean that the backup system that safeguards went down as well somehow?
Well, frankly,
or is there a backup system?
When a major, you're getting to exactly what we need to do to modernize the grid so that we don't rely upon specific pathways, for example, to serve a huge load like, say, New York City and have the capability to get around it. Actually, technologies are really here or on the verge of being here that could be employed, but we don't have the rules very well set. For example, who makes the investment? Who profits from running the lines? These things are all in flux, and frankly, we need some, in my view, national leadership right now to get these rules of the road straight.
Ernest Moniz, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Ernest Moniz is with us. He's former Undersecretary of Energy. We have a major power blackout tonight in the Northeast, in New York, into the Midwest, Detroit, Toronto, Ottawa. Scenes of, not chaos, but pretty crazy scenes from New York. If you've got direct reports, let us know what you've seen. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. What is now being described as the largest ever power blackout hit the eastern United States today. Everybody's focused on New York, but it has stretched right across the eastern U.S. into the Midwest, Detroit, on up into also Cleveland, into Toronto and Ottawa, Canada. No very clear news yet on exactly how it happened, but the power is out over a very large area. Subways shut down, airports shut down, elevators stuck in high-rises, people walking home in vast numbers. It is an unusual night, a hot night, and soon a dark night in New York and other cities around the United States and Canada. The mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, not long ago spoke to the city and the country to reassure them that power would be coming back on soon.
The first thing that everybody should do is to understand that there is no evidence of any terrorism whatsoever. For some reason or other, there was a power failure in northern New York or southern Canada that cascaded down through the system and affected the power grid as far east as Connecticut, as far south as New Jersey, and as far west as Ohio. We will be starting up power in the city. It will take a decent amount of time, hours, not minutes, and nobody really can be any more specific than that.
We have heard voices from New York tonight, and we'll hear voices from elsewhere around the U.S. and Canada with the latest reports on what people are experiencing in the streets and what's going on behind the scenes to get power back up across the country. There, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg saying this is not, was not terror-related, the first thought of many New Yorkers and others beyond New York. I'm joined by Ernest Moniz, professor of physics at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and former Undersecretary of Energy in the Clinton administration. Ernest Moniz, there we hear the mayor of New York saying he had a cascading problem, that the power is coming back up. It will take time, but it will be back up. Could be hours. How does power resume after such a massive blackout and a massive grid failure? Give us the thumbnail on how the energy industry goes about restarting this.
Well, of course, it depends to a certain extent in terms of what is discovered in terms of the origin. For example, conceivably, there's a major piece of equipment that must be replaced, a big transformer or something like this, which could take, I'm afraid to say, sometimes much more than simply hours. But in a normal restart, again, as I said earlier, mm-hmm. this is a very complicated synchronized machine. And basically, the transmission grid and all the power plants have to be brought up and dispatched into the grid in a way that keeps the load balanced. So still, it's a complex process.
Still trying to have a sense of, if I'm in New York with my light on, where is the power coming from that powers that light bulb?
Well, the electricity basically flows, roughly speaking, according to the path of least resistance. That is, it's a balanced flow through all the lines. You certainly cannot track. You cannot say that, you know, a particular, shall we say, electron from one power plant is the one that follows a pathway to your house, typically. Mm-hmm. So it's a distributed system mm-hmm. with the overall grid being balanced to supply the load. Again, we have typically, except tonight, of course, in New York or Ottawa or Detroit, we're accustomed to flipping the switch and immediately the light goes on.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, that's the end of an enormously complicated synchronized machine that we have let get very, very outdated.
And give us a sense, we don't know exactly what's going on this evening, and we will not pretend to, but you must have thought about this as Undersecretary of Energy. You see how big the blackout is. Give us a best case, worst case. What's the sort of least problem that may have developed today to cause this, and how would that be fixed? And what's the worst case? You say some of these repairs could take much more than hours. If it were really bad, what might that be? Give us a best, worst case scenario here.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I'll say best or worst, but let's take two different examples. One is, if you remember, I forget the exact year, but several years ago, there was a very, very major West Coast blackout. And that, in the end, was caused by essentially one tree hitting one high-voltage transmission line. Mm. That line went down, and essentially the West Coast went down. So that was a question basically of just getting that line back up, and it was a reasonably prompt restart. As I said earlier, however, you could have, of course, no one is arguing, I believe, today that this is any kind of terrorist act or anything mm-hmm. of this type. Mm-hmm. But if you did have, let's say, a synchronized or accidental outage of, let's say, several major transformers, you simply may have a hard time finding the appropriate replacements for that, and it could be more of a day's issue.
So days
we have seen in some major storms in parts of the country.
And do you have any idea what the plans are for cities the size of New York if they were to face a power outage that would last for days?
No, to be honest, I don't. Other than to say the obvious, it would be an extraordinarily uncomfortable and difficult period.
I mean, there's no way to just turn on a generator and make up that kind of massive energy loss.
Well, of course, many companies, for example, larger concerns do, of course, have backup power because they can't afford the loss of, for example, data that might occur. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know, especially some years ago, more than today, even slight disturbances would have all of our clocks in our house, you know, reset, right?
Right.
To midnight and blink, mm-hmm. and it's extremely annoying. Well, now imagine that you're running a big server farm, let's say, for a credit card operation. You simply can't afford that. So there's a lot of backup power now being put in place, some of which is because of the digital economy, much of which is because we don't have a sufficiently reliable transmission system that they can rely upon it.
An old dirt road, as you say. Ernest Moniz, I have to ask you, and I have to let you go in just a minute, but because you have an op-ed piece on the an essay on the op-ed page of the New York Times today promoting nuclear power. You say that the country needs nuclear power to have a safe and sufficient energy supply in the future. How does the nuclear question come into what happened today, or does it at all? Are you really focused on inadequate transmission facilities, or does the source of the power matter?
I think the reliability issues that we're talking about today are almost certainly will prove to be principally from the transmission grid. Now, the nuclear power piece that we had today in the New York Times, John Deutsch and myself, was really focused on meeting our power needs, our energy needs, while responding to the challenge of global warming and climate change, because nuclear power is essentially a pollution-free energy source. So that was really the focus there. Indeed, of course, nuclear power plants tend to be very, very large typically, and they will be important in our view, for meeting environmental concerns and supply. However, very relevant to the issue of the transmission grid is another set of initiatives in which we would want much smaller power plants, perhaps photovoltaic plants, could be wind plants, smaller natural gas-fired plants.
Smaller and more widely dispersed, not so far from the point of use.
Exactly. And that, of course, is another way of relieving all this congestion on the grid by having your power plants better dispersed towards the load.
Ernest Moniz, we come away with a much clearer understanding of how all this works and what may be going wrong tonight. As you say, old dirt roads carrying an awful lot of traffic in terms of power tonight, and maybe a failure along one of those roads. Thank you very much for your time with us this evening.
Welcome.
Ernest Moniz is professor of physics at MIT. He was undersecretary of energy for the Clinton administration. He co-authored a piece in the New York Times today on nuclear power. The power blackout that has hit New York today extends far beyond New York. Cleveland, Detroit, towns and cities in between, and right into Canada. In Toronto, the subway system shut down, traffic lights not working, airports affected by the power outage. I'm joined right now from Toronto by Beatrice Paliti. She's a reporter with CBC Television News. Hello, Beatrice Paliti. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
So give us a sense. Lots of Americans have been focused on New York, but you've got plenty going on there. What's the impact of the blackout on Toronto?
Essentially, the only people who are benefiting from this blackout right now are the hot dog vendors on the streets of Toronto, because it's pretty much the only place that you can get a cooked meal at this point. The entire city, there's a power outage affecting the entire city. That's about 3 million people. So there's no air conditioning, aside from, you know, the air conditioning that might have been left behind before the power outage occurred at 4:15 p.m. Eastern time. Nobody can cook. Refrigeration, obviously, is not happening. People are filing out of the city in cars. There's been a great deal of traffic and motor vehicular traffic and pedestrian traffic in the city. It's caused traffic gridlock. We have police officers and Toronto Transit drivers who've abandoned their streetcars in the tracks directing traffic, as well as regular people in Toronto. So if you look outside our windows, our studios here in Toronto, there are a lot of people walking the streets and a lot of cars on the roadways.
And Beatrice, what are Canadian authorities saying about when power might be restored?
Well, this is the big question. They're not sure. They say that it's not going to be a matter of minutes. It's definitely going to be a matter of hours. However, there is some good news at this point. The entire province has been affected by this blackout, and that's about 12 million people or so. And we are receiving reports that there's some places about an hour and a half west of Toronto where power is beginning to come back on. But officials here are not committing to any time. At this point, our hydro companies are trying to do what's called decoupling our grid from the U.S. grid and hope to be able to get our power back on again. In terms of the causes of this, people had been entertaining some sort of lightning strike at a power plant on the U.S. side of Niagara Falls. But now it seems the latest explanation at this point is that there was an overload in the system and that a fire occurred at a power plant in the U.S., the Consolidated Edison Power Plant, after incredibly high demand. Apparently there was a fire there, and that is why we're seeing outages that are basically cascading across this large area.
It's an interesting dynamic tonight, Beatrice. We have officials in New York sort of looking north toward Canada, suggesting that the problem is up there. And meanwhile, we're here in Canada looking south. This could have been anticipated. We read that Toronto depends on power more than most cities to move its water supply. Is there a threat to Toronto's water supply?
At this point, water spokespeople in Toronto are advising people not to use water unless it's absolutely necessary. Our reservoirs here apparently can supply the city for about a maximum of 24 hours. So if this problem isn't solved in that period of time, there could be some serious issues.
Have you been out on the streets, Beatrice?
I have.
And what are people, was there any terrorism concern in Toronto when this first happened? And how are people looking forward to the dark of night? Do you have a history of problems in the streets with blackouts in Toronto?
Well, in speaking with police earlier this evening at one of their first hourly updates, they say that they're not too concerned that there's going to be any sort of looting. However, darkness has not yet fallen. It seems, though, that many people on the street were taking this in stride. Very few people seemed angry. They were very patient, many of them speaking on their cell phones, many obviously obeying the commands from police officers, from Toronto Transit drivers, and from regular people directing traffic. So it seems at this point that that people simply took the opportunity to head home a little bit early. So it doesn't seem that people are too worried about it at this point. However, we are only three hours and 15 minutes into this power outage, and we're told that we should have power restored, or that officials hope to have power restored by the morning.
Well, Canadian cousin, we are all on the same grid tonight, and we wish you well there.
Thank you very much.
Beatrice Politi is a reporter with CBC Television News. She joined us from Toronto. We are looking at the power blackout tonight that is affecting very broad swaths of the United States and Canada, as you have surely heard by this point, from New York to Cleveland to Detroit to Toronto, Ottawa, many towns and cities beyond. The precise source not known at this point. We've heard a half a dozen different potential explanations here tonight, from lightning strikes to overloaded transmission plants, and widely varying expectations of when the power may come back on. Mayor Michael Bloomberg in New York says it's coming back on, but it may be hours, and even that sounds like it may be optimistic. On the other hand, reports just there from Toronto that it's already coming on in some of the outlying areas around Toronto. I am joined now from New York by Eric Kleinenberg. He's assistant professor of sociology at New York University and author of Heat Wave, a social autopsy of disaster in Chicago. Eric Kleinenberg, good evening and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
And at the same time, from Washington, D.C., by Ellen Berman. She's president of the Consumer Energy Council of America. Hi, Ellen Berman. Thanks for being with us. Ellen Berman, are you there? We'll turn to her in a moment. Eric Kleinenberg, you have written about, well, what you describe as a social autopsy of what can happen in a heat wave of disaster in Chicago. You're looking out your window, I presume, or have been in the streets of New York tonight. Do you see a disaster unfolding?
Well, it's certainly a crisis of some kind. We have people walking through the streets to try to get home. A number of people are obviously stuck in subways. They have to be rescued by officials. A lot of people are stuck because they can't get into Manhattan, and they live in the city. So it's just a few hours into this event, but there's certainly a lot of anxiety in New York.
We turn to you as a sociologist because it's very clear right away that public officials have sociological circumstances very much in mind. Bloomberg coming quickly to say this is not terrorism, the power's coming back, everybody working to be very reassuring. And from everything we've seen and heard, New York is responding fairly well to that. But how does the social psychology of an event like this work, Eric Kleinenberg? How do people process such a sudden, you know, interruption of the status quo and decide how they're going to respond to it?
Well, you've been talking about that a little bit in your comparison between how the people of Toronto and the people of New York are reacting to this event. Obviously, New Yorkers are still raw from the events of September 11th, and there is, as I said, some anxiety here about the possibility of a terrorist attack. I was in my office at New York University when the power first went out, and a number of people went out into the hallways and then into the streets, with the first question on their minds being, what went wrong here? Is there some kind of attack? And immediately, I think you're right again to bring up the role of officials in all of this. And excuse me if the sounds from outside start to come in. New York is like that with the windows open on a night like tonight. But we all understand the incredible power of officials to provide a public message that explains to all of us what's happening. And, of course, we depend on officials at a moment like this to give us information that otherwise is just impossible for us to get on our own or even for journalists to get. And so it was important for Mayor Bloomberg to say this is not a terrorist attack. If you know, once he knew that for sure, we obviously needed something to reduce the possibility of a panic, and there was no panic here in New York.
What are you expecting as darkness falls in the city? I mean, that's not a comfortable situation in any major city, and New York has a history.
That's right, and we're about 30 minutes from sundown right now. The mayor has said he'll do, you know, he's doing everything possible, and officials are doing everything possible to try to get the lights back on before sundown. But as you said, not clear that that's going to happen. So far, we've had an extraordinary amount of civility in the streets in New York, people sharing rides to get home, civilians directing traffic. I even saw a car come by with a driver who rolled down his window to apologize to people in the streets because he had to get by them.
What city are you in?
It's extraordinary. And things like that do happen when you have a break from the norm. But on the other hand, we also know that those kinds of breaks don't last all that long. And so, of course, the deeper concern that people have is that if it gets dark, the power stays out for hours or days, that then you have the more serious kinds of breakdowns. And, of course, this is a city with a lot of collective goodwill right now, and I think a city that's aware of the kinds of things it can do to try to keep the order. But, again, it's very early, and we're going to have to see what happens.
A lot of goodwill right now, but no power. In New York and cities beyond, we're talking about a major power blackout in New York and stretching all the way to Cleveland, Detroit, up into Canada, Toronto, Ottawa. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We'll turn to your calls after the break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking at a massive power blackout tonight in New York and far beyond. New reports just in that power is beginning to come back on in the western and northern edges of New York City. Department of Homeland Security continuing to say terrorism is not suspected, though the exact source of the huge outage today over large portions of the northeastern and upper Midwest United States and of Canada, exact source still unknown. New York City has announced it is mobilizing 40,000 police officers and the entire fire department for special evening duty. New York State lost 80% of its power today. Wall Street is saying that it will be open for business tomorrow morning as usual, even if they have to use backup power. The effects are far beyond New York and Albany. People stuck in elevators in Cleveland. Nurses reporting laboring moms are suffering in the maternity wards because they don't have the power to keep it cool. We are joined tonight by Eric Kleinenberg. He's an assistant professor of sociology at New York University who has looked at what happens in disasters, in quick and sudden dramatic changes of circumstance in cities like New York. We're joined right now by another voice from New York. Daniel Schneider, an attorney, joins us from Scarsdale, New York. He's home. He made it up from Brooklyn. Dan Schneider, what did you see in Brooklyn this afternoon? You were in the middle of some kind of a legal proceeding at 4 o'clock, and what happened?
Well, the lights went out. Luckily, we were in a room with a window, so we could see. We could continue for a few minutes, but the entire building went out. And beyond that, we didn't know. We didn't know if it was an attack or if it was a blackout. Everybody started going down the stairs in a pretty orderly manner, and it was just a question of trying to get out of the city.
You were just a few blocks from the Brooklyn Bridge, where we saw on 9/11 people streaming over from Lower Manhattan. Today, people streaming over just to get home, to get back to Brooklyn or out of the city. What was your first thought? Did terrorism come to mind?
It did. I happened to be in almost the same place on 9/11 and was able to look out of a window and see people streaming across the Brooklyn Bridge to get out of Manhattan with plumes of smoke rising. And today, when I was in the car trying to go over the Brooklyn Bridge towards Manhattan to get on the East Side Highway, it was so reminiscent. There were tons of people coming across the bridge, and when I actually got on the bridge, one of the lanes was closed to traffic because there were just people walking in the left lane, a mass of humanity trying to get out of the city.
Dan Schneider, you're a lifelong New Yorker. What's your sense of the city as we head into darkness tonight? Are you feeling confident? So far, fairly civil New York City and fairly orderly. What's your level of confidence that that will go on into the night?
Oh, great confidence. I think there were a lot of people helping out, directing traffic, picking up people who are hitchhiking on the road, doing everything they could to cooperate. I think it's going to be just fine.
Well, we'll hope for that. Daniel Schneider, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dan Schneider, a New Yorker who made his way out of the city today, but with the memories that many New Yorkers must have had of 9/11 and this kind of flitting fear of a terrorism connection that has not turned out to be the case, at least not as far as we know at this point. I'm joined tonight by Eric Kleinenberg from New York City. He's an assistant professor of sociology at NYU. And now from Washington, D.C., by Ellen Berman, president of the Consumer Energy Council of America. Good evening and welcome, Ellen Berman.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Ellen Berman, you're paying a lot of attention to energy issues, and today watching, as all of us are, as a very large chunk of the country deals with a complete power outage. Your thoughts, what's your response to what's happened this evening?
Well, my heart goes out to everybody who's suffering with no power and no heat, no electricity in this heat. I must say I feel a little guilty sitting in my air-conditioned office in Washington where it hasn't yet hit us. But this was coming.
Why do you say this was coming? Why do you expect it's going to come more and more?
Well, I hate to say we were prescient, but we really were. For the past couple years, the Consumer Energy Council of America has been looking at the state of reliability of the nation's transmission system, and it is very fragile, and we have been living on borrowed time. The industry has done an incredible job getting power to all of us, but the system has not been upgraded in decades and decades, over 50 years, and our needs have grown exponentially. We've never seen any time in history with the demands on the power system that the digital economy has brought, and the system really isn't equipped to handle everybody using their power at once like they are on a hot, humid day like today.
If the system's not equipped for that, Ellen Berman, is the country equipped? Is it in a position fiscally, financially, to make the kind of upgrade to the system that would push this threat of further blackouts away?
Well,
can we afford it?
That's an excellent question, and we actually can afford it. If you look at the cost of lost productivity due to the outages, that's money down the drain that we will never see again. Mm-hmm. If the tens of billions of dollars that are spent annually by consumers and businesses in such not outages like this, but far more minor outages, if that money were put into improving the transmission system and deploying technologies to make the system much more expansive and more robust and more willing to withstand the kind of demands that we have had today, then that's an investment that benefits society.
Well, but of course, the cost of a blackout, everybody just has to pay. It's not voluntary. Paying for upgrades to infrastructure has been famously difficult to arrange politically in the United States. Ellen Berman, Eric Klenenberg, we have callers who want to join us. I want to turn to them. Scott's calling from Danbury, Connecticut. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind tonight?
It just drives home the point that conservation is needed, and we are a wasteful society. We could do a lot better by conserving energy. The states can do a lot better by not raiding conservation funds. In the state of Connecticut, they are tapping into a ratepayer-funded fund that aids conservation to solve a fiscal crisis. And that, in the end, is adding to the demand on the power grid, and it's one thing that really needs to be addressed.
So you see you look at the blackout, and you see a failure to conserve energy. Scott, thanks for your call. Ellen Berman, let me put that to you. You pointed first to an inadequate infrastructure that's outdated, that needs upgrading. We had a guest earlier who described it as a dirt road carrying superhighway traffic. What's more important here, conservation or infrastructure upgrades to the transmission system?
Well, obviously, they're both very important. Dr. Moniz talked about small forms of energy production that can be deployed close to where they're used. That's called distributed energy or distributed power resources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That can be used to alleviate the kinds of pressures that we had today. Hospitals typically have backup systems for when the power goes out. They have electric generators. There are generators, there's diesel equipment, there are gas turbines.
But all of that goes to equipment, not to conservation. Does that suggest that you see the kind of material side of the equation, not the conservation side, is the most important in addressing the blackout threat?
No, I think they're both important. I think upgrading the transmission system is extremely important so that it can carry power more efficiently. I think appliances, which use less energy, are very important. I think demand-side programs, which utilities can implement, which allow you and me perhaps a price advantage if they cycle off our air conditioner for 15 minutes every hour. That's important. Other ways of meeting our power needs are important. It's an interlocking puzzle.
So let's do both, but it takes a lot of willpower to do those things. Stefan's calling from Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Stefan. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. We actually still have power down here in the Deep South.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But I had a question, which is, I wonder if there is a tension between the value of a public figure like Mayor Bloomberg offering that reassuring message from City Hall that there's no evidence of terrorism, and the possible risk that at some later time it may become clear that he was wrong. For instance, if this actually did start from a fire in a power station, as it's reported, usually an arson investigation to figure out if that fire was set intentionally or not will take some time, and it certainly is at least some chance that that's the case. How does a public official negotiate that without winding up at some risk at a later time after the investigations are completed?
Got it. Stefan, it's a great question, and I want to come at it from two directions. And I should say, first of all, I've just got a news update here that Canada's Prime Minister Jean Chrétien's office is now saying that lightning in Niagara, New York power plant caused the blackout. But maybe that's so. Who knows? There'll still be a lot of investigation, I'm sure. But Eric Klenenberg, let me put it to you first. Here comes the question. The doubt as to the official explanation, the assurance today that this wasn't terrorism, Given the experience of this country in the last 2 years, I suppose it's not surprising that not everyone is going to take official statements at face value necessarily. You were, if I heard you correctly, you were suggesting earlier the importance of Bloomberg being honest and forthright with what's really known exactly to maintain the kind of credibility that our caller Stefan's talking about.
I think that's right, and it's an enormously risky venture to speak before we have definitive knowledge on something like this. So to the extent that officials make definitive statements, you know, we're certain that this is not a case of terrorism, they run the risk of having a major breakdown in trust if it turns out subsequently that they were wrong about that. And so it's a very high-stakes decision. My sense is that a number of people here recognize that and therefore are credulous when they hear an official report that, you know, they're going to trust it at this point. But I want to contrast this, for example, with the story that we're hearing today, you know, this morning in Europe. The thousands of people are dying in a heat wave, just as 700 people died in a heat wave in Chicago in 1995. And it's useful to step back for a moment and to think about these things comparatively. In those cases, we are seeing so much reluctance to acknowledge the severity of the problem or the sources of the problem that there was not the official declaration of an emergency and the generation of a response, even that those, you know, places and governments were capable of. Mm. So your caller is right. It's a fine line that governments have to watch. What we can say at this point is that New York has done what seems to be an effective job at generating an emergency response, you know, getting things in place. And, you know, we should hope that the reporting so far has been accurate, because it's absolutely dangerous politically to mislead the public on an issue like
that. Any other way. And Ellen Berman, I should say CNN is now confirming that the origin of the blackout was a lightning strike in Niagara, New York. Though, again, I have the sense that we should not judge too quickly. But to the substance of our caller's question, and our time is short, is it possible that what looks like a natural source could actually be a terrorist source? Or do you think that it will ultimately be quite clear what happened here?
I'd like to put my trust in Mayor Bloomberg. I don't know. How can you know until you investigate? But if Canada is saying definitively that they see the source of a lightning strike, I'm willing to take that on face value. And whether it's a lightning strike or whether it's terrorism, the same responses need to be done, which are a multi-pronged approach to conservation, to distributed energy, to improving the transmission grid.
And either way, our vulnerability, even to lightning, even to nature, is shown again tonight and being experienced in cities across this country and across Canada. Ellen Berman, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Ellen Berman is president of the Consumer Energy Council of America. And Eric Kleinenberg in New York City, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to turn to our on-point news analyst, Jack Beattie, who is watching the blackout from a safe distance in New Hampshire this evening. Jack, your thoughts as you watch millions of people cope with no juice.
Well, these disasters are always social mirrors, aren't they? We look in them, and what do we see? What about America do we see? Do we see what we saw in New York in 1977 and 1965, anarchy, looting, violence, especially among poor people? Do we see what we saw in Chicago in the summer of 1995, monstrous indifference to people with 700 people dying in one day, dozens of bodies unclaimed because no family members were known for these people? Mm. Or will we see what we saw on September 11th, solidarity, mutual aid, people looking out for one another, even self-sacrifice? These are occasions to sort of, I won't say the soul of the nation, but to sort of look at its social capital. And we know we're at an end of a decade when sociologists say social capital has been eroding rapidly. And let's hope that there's plenty on supply, even if not electricity on supply, in New York City.
We will hope exactly that. It has to be said at this hour, that glimpse into the soul is looking pretty darn good. But it's getting darker in New York, and this story is not over. We will be following it right through the night, I'm sure, on public radio across the country. Jack Beattie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, more news to come at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.